everyone, and welcome back to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnell Doré, and joining me today is Elaine Durbach. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, Arnell.
Hey, for our new listeners, Naturalistic Support is an approach to lasting personal growth and healthier, more satisfying relationships. On Naturalistic Support, we combine a progressive understanding of our human experience with peer support. And in that way, we help each other. This happens when you call us to talk about yourselves and to talk to each other. Our number is 212-209-2877. And today, we're considering, again, how naturalistic humanism has far-reaching implications for our entire society. Each week we demonstrate that naturalistic humanism supports lasting personal growth and healthier, satisfying relationships, and it provides an approach to building dynamic experimental communities. But naturalistic humanism also has profound implications for how we can create a more socially just, equitable, and peaceful society. What happens if we let go of blame and judgmental thinking when we try to rebuild our social institutions? Last week, we talked about how in the past few decades, we've seen a lot of hard-won social progress become erased. It's hard to believe, but 50 years ago, our federal government played an active role in creating decent, affordable public housing, in fully supporting the Voting Rights Act, and in declaring a war on poverty. And even less than 50 years ago, a woman's right to terminating an unwanted pregnancy was protected by the nation's highest court. Today, achievements like these and so many others have been rolled back. Last week, we started to consider why so much hard-won ground has been lost. Now, there are always many factors that affect public policy. But what probably has the greatest impact is our underlying beliefs about how we understand the human experience. Last week, we discussed how the Christian Bible, which carries an outside influence on the way the average American thinks, has been the justification of both ultra-conservatives and progressives alike. So that fact might lead some to conclude that the Bible is politically neutral. But the victims of atrocities like slavery, land theft, and military conquest, all justified in the Bible, would probably be somewhat less than pleased to learn that the Bible has also helped some oppose slavery and fight to ameliorate poverty. Even if we overlook the millennia of outrageous harms that the Bible and religion has been used to rationalize and agree to call it neutral, the influence of the Bible and traditional religious thinking does more than simply suggest how we should treat each other. The Bible informs us that our basic human nature is to be greedy, lazy, and antisocial. The Bible also teaches that any person can radically change their path in life. All that is required is they make the choice to do so. So these ideas are contrary to implementing lasting progressive change, and they're neither supported by reason-based thinking or by science. If it's true that people are inherently selfish, lazy, and antisocial, how can a generous social safety net be justified? Actually, it can't be, because a generous social safety net would reward people for being selfish and lazy. But what does social science tell us about human nature? Actually, the exact opposite. When people are the beneficiaries of sufficient developmental support and life support, they're naturally inclined to be cooperative and caring, with a strong desire to participate and contribute, precisely what society needs from them. The traditional and faith-based belief that anyone can change their life simply by exercising their free will also supports a truly conservative agenda. If being successful in life is simply a matter of individual choice, how could significant social intervention make sense? It doesn't. According to traditional and faith-based thinking, those who want to change will do so on their own. And for those who don't, all of the government checks in the world won't fix it. But a reason-based, naturalistic understanding makes it clear that our genetic and environmental determinants are always causing us to behave exactly as we do. There's no magical way that we can disconnect ourselves from everything that leads us to where we are. Through this lens, there's no justification for rewarding some while punishing others. We are all subject to circumstances that we do not choose. While it's wonderful that many people are inspired by their faith to fight for progressive social and political change, it's also important to recognize that frequently traditional faith-based ideas about the human experience are cynical and misanthropic. Unless we challenge these underlying anachronistic ideas, any progressive changes that are achieved today can easily again be lost. The naturalistic view of our human experience provides us an effective way to think about ourselves, providing a solid basis for progressive change that will last. To make an effective argument that supports lasting progressive change, both deterministic and humanistic ideas are necessary. So let's explain that a little bit. And we lost Elaine at one point, but I think she's back. Are you back with us, Elaine?
Can you hear me? Yeah, we can hear you.
Let's.
I'm having trouble keeping our script up.
Okay.
I'm listening. Listening and enjoying.
Yeah, we could. We you could. You could just wing it.
I'll question you each time I want to, because you're covering so much intense material.
That's true. It is intense. So, both humanists and determinists would like to see some social economic changes, but separately, neither perspective can make a compelling argument for the fundamental sweeping changes that could be made were they combined. And here's why. Determinists generally do not share the humanistic belief in our social nature. They tend to see people as being born, at best, in a neutral state. Aside from genetic tendencies, of course. And at worst, they see people as being inclined toward selfish, lazy, and greedy behavior. For them, having positive and negative reinforcements is a necessary and effective way to motivate socially desirable behaviors. Without them recognizing our natural inclination toward desirable social behaviors, many determinists fail to see a compelling case for significant societal change. They might say, while the disparity of circumstances that one is born into may not be fair, ultimately, our system of rewards and punishments is what gets people to behave in beneficial ways that otherwise they would not. Humanists who do not see how our behavior is determined are also poor advocates for sweeping progressive change. To most humanists, while healthy humans will be inclined toward desirable social behavior, for those individuals who are unhealthy, changing is ultimately considered to be a choice that each person must individually make. To most humanists, all of the social support that can be given is not as significant as an individual's personal desire to change. For this reason, humanists who fail to recognize that our behaviors are determined will also not support sweeping progressive change. They would say, it's a waste to spend society's resources trying to get someone to change if they themselves do not decide to do so. So while the perspective of both determinists and humanists might support some limited social redistribution of resources, neither group, on the strength of their own perspective, have the rationale for the seismic shift that's required. The insight, Elaine, we're currently on page 11, if you have access to this. The insights of humanists in combination with the insights of determinists provide exactly the right set of ideas, though, to support intensive and, this is important, enduring substantial socioeconomic change and accomplish it in a manner that's peaceful and kind. So if you can see what we're setting up here, each idea, like the ideas of determinists and the ideas of humanists, they really solve the other's obstacle to supporting substantive change. So the problem with the determinist perspective is there are unfair outcomes as a result of unfair starting conditions. The solution would be significant social economic change, but the obstacle is they believe we need the punishment and rewards that we have. Otherwise, people will be naturally antisocial or at best neutral, but they will not behave in a desirable way. The humanist view removes that obstacle because if people's developmental needs are met, they're naturally going to be inclined to behave as we need them to. Now, the problem with the humanist perspective without the determinism is that that without meeting people's developmental needs, much human potential is wasted. That's the humanist view of the problem. But social economic change is not going to be sufficient if you believe that ultimately people have the choice is theirs. They have to assert their free will, and ultimately. You know, no matter how much you throw at that problem, it's not going to solve it. So if humanists had the determinist view, that would remove that obstacle, because what makes some change in others is not about personal choice. It's an understanding that it's about determinants that are not chosen.
Arnel, this is such a dense material. You're giving us an enormous amount to digest.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question here? I know, you know, we're looking at people who suffered disadvantages, who have less education, who have less benefit of all kinds. But are there people in the privileged classes who've got everything that money can buy, but who are deprived of emotional support? You know, even Trump, apparently his mother really didn't like him.
Yeah, it's not just...
He had a father who was brutal.
Right, right. Getting what you need developmentally is physical things. You know, it's safety and security, that your physical well-being will be protected and all that. But it's also all the things you emotionally need. And you're 100% right that, you know, that whole theory about people behave in social ways if they get what they need would be belied if it didn't also include the emotional and intellectual environment that nurtures healthy people. Because we have an entire ruling elite that, you know, they have no shortage of material access to plenty, but that in many, many, many cases, maybe the vast majority of cases, is not enough to create a socially beneficial person.
So many of them are miserable.
They're miserable, and they make other people miserable.
So even in terms of, as you said, the meritocracy, they don't necessarily score.
Yeah, so in our system, you know, moving to meritocracy, you know, we have this notion that a meritocratic system is really the best way forward, because those people who contribute get rewarded, and people who don't are motivated to contribute because that way they'll get rewarded. But there are a million problems with a meritocracy, none the least of which is that what we have pretends to be a true meritocracy, but it's really far from that. Are you able to read a little bit about meritocracy to us?
Yeah, that would be great. I can pick it up here. This is fascinating to me. I've never thought of it this way. You're pointing out that only recently have humans been able to produce a continuous supply of surplus resources. And to apportion the surplus, a system based on domination emerged and has been present ever since. And domination systems enable a select few to enjoy concentrated power and wealth by setting rivals and subordinate groups against one another. We're seeing that happen right now, right in this country.
Absolutely.
And groups might be turned against each other based on their tribal or ethnic, religious, racial, linguistic, sexual, gender, or any other identity differences. And within groups, elites' access to actual resource is enforced by police power, and between groups, by militia. Interesting definition there, the differentiation.
Yeah,
and you point out that the key elements in every stratified society is the assumed superiority of some deserving of reward and the inferiority of others, therefore not getting these rewards. And today we regard certain groups and individuals as worthy of enjoying preferential access to resources, to power and influence, because they are believed to have merit, presenting virtuous characteristics or admirable behaviors.
Yep.
This is the essence of meritocracy, isn't it?
Yep, that's exactly what's the system of meritocracy. That's how it's supposed to be, supposedly. Let me just pick up a little here. Reflective of earlier domination systems, meritocracy lavishes rewards on those who are deemed worthy. while allowing those regarded as unworthy to endure hardship and sometimes serious harm. So, a common critique of our meritocratic system is that it's not meritocratic enough. And this is known as an aspirational critique. So the idea is that if the system really worked the way a meritocracy is supposed to work, it would be fine. So it's well known that the way things are, being born into the elite class results in advantages which ensure remaining in that class, regardless of whether they're virtual characteristics or behaviors. The aspirational critique argues that if factors which weaken meritocratic effects, such as nepotism, which we've all seen the best example of in our current administration, cronyism, which also is all there for obvious, and corruption also there, were eliminated from our entire society, we would greatly benefit. And although, you know, this might be somewhat true, fixing our meritocratic system so it operates more consistently with its ideals would be an improvement. From a naturalistic vantage point, a more effective meritocratic system would still be problematic. And that's because the underlying assumptions about human nature on which our system is built are incorrect, resulting in a fundamental misalignment between what humans need and what they receive. Based on the belief that humans are driven by selfishness and greed and a reluctance to contribute unless coerced, our system relies on positive and negative reinforces. So when trained for a position in high demand, such as a registered nurse or an engineer, society reinforces that contribution with relatively good salaries sufficient for a decent life. Taking a path in conflict with society, like drug addiction, results in a barrage of undesirable consequences, including rejection by family, friends, poverty, violence, incarceration, sickness, and in many cases, an early demise.
I'm thinking of some of the other people who come into conflict as well, like artists or writers or independent thinkers who struggle to survive because the society doesn't reward people who step out of the mold.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's reasonable for society to encourage behaviors that benefit it and discourage behaviors that harm it. But our current system takes positive and negative reinforcements to outrageous extremes. We allow an elite few to enjoy lives of limitless luxury and political influence, while others remain burdened with mounting debt, struggling for their entire lives to afford life's essentials, such as decent housing, medical insurance, and healthy food. And if our human nature actually made us as selfish, greedy, and unmotivated to contribute as is commonly assumed, then our system of extreme reward for some and hardship and punishment for others might be defensible. But because human nature is substantially different from what's commonly assumed, our socioeconomic system and our human nature are critically misaligned.
You think this is why people doing the kind of work where they're motivated by good nature or by their passions, you know, nursery school teachers, even some of the healthcare workers too, people looking after the elderly, don't get rewarded? That it's assumed that they'll do this work, and they're left by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, look, most jobs, we basically assume that people would never do them if they weren't economically coerced. And, you know, it's just really wrong. People, you know, if we make sure that people aren't panicking, trying to make the ends meet at the end of the month, if people cannot have that kind of stress in their lives, they're going to be able to contribute a lot more of what we need rather than stressing out, you know, most of the entire population. Our number is 212-209-2877, and we'd like to hear what you think about the naturalistic humanist position on these issues having to do with a generous social safety net, having to do with the kind of underlying beliefs that we're going to need in order to have progressive change that we can sustain, to have progressive change that 25, 50 years from now isn't all rolled back. And they'll say, wow, you know, in the late 2020s, there were some progressives that really made some incredible strides. But now, you know, all that's being undone by the current administration, which, you know, that's what's happening now. And there's no reason, unless we change our underlying beliefs about the human experience, why it's not going to happen again.
I like what, you know, your findings give that glimmer of hope when you point out that you know, the scientists, that social psychology and neuroscience show that when healthy, mature humans have had their developmental needs supported, they're actually inclined to be cooperative and caring and to want to participate and contribute. Exactly. Yep. What society needs.
Absolutely. And of course, the opposite is true, too. When a person's developmental needs are neglected, or if that person has been subject to deprivation or abuse, the chances of their fullest human potential being realized is severely reduced. So by not assuring sufficient access to the resources essential for a healthy, stable development environment for all, our system disenfranchises masses of people, resulting in an immense amount of unrealized human potential. And unrealized human potential does even more to harm society than just being deprived of all the lost contributions. Because when someone's raised in conditions that fail to support their essential developmental needs, there's an increased likelihood that their human nature will be expressed in ways that are harmful to society. Our number is 212-209-2877. We're going to take our halfway break, and we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Naturalistic Support right here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York.
Non-commercial, listener-sponsored.
Peace and Justice Radio.
On Wednesdays from 2 to 3, Naturalistic Support is taking listener calls, offering a revolutionary new way to think about ourselves and reach out to each other.
I just wanted to call in to give encouragement to the last caller.
I am right at this moment.
You really hit the proverbial nail on the head.
I really connected with what you were saying about loneliness.
We are hardwired to help each other.
Getting past the blame, owning your own truth, letting go of judgmental thoughts.
I felt so fortunate to hear this.
You went through every single one of the things that I've been working on with my life. Now you said all that, I'm like, holy cow, what is this guy doing? Is he talking to me right now?
The Naturalistic Revolution is a game changer. Listen to us break it down on Wednesdays from 2 to 3.
I want to thank you so much. You helped me so much.
Thank you.
listening to Naturalistic Support. We're talking about naturalistic humanism in society and how, if we're going to have progressive change that lasts, we're going to need to revamp our underlying understanding of what motivates the kinds of behavior society needs and how we should think about the human experience in a way that will support lasting progressive change. So, from a naturalistic humanist perspective, a more just system would have far less disparate outcomes, and everyone would be regarded as worthy of protection from the violence and suffering that result from being deprived of the resources needed for a decent life. So, I want to talk about how we can get there. What are the obstacles to having the changes that we need to see? Elaine, you're still with us, right?
I am.
Okay, good. We're on page 28 here, talking about getting there.
I'm right there with you.
Okay.
Good. Okay.
Can you take it from there?
Yeah, from a naturalistic, humanistic perspective, the way change is accomplished, is this where we are?
For our system to progress toward that kind of change, a substantial majority of our compatriots must agree, right? So this is the section about how we get there. It's called getting there.
Yes, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so without widespread support, the only other way that such sweeping change could occur has far more potential to be disastrous than beneficial, involving the ascension of a vanguard who forcibly imposed their will upon the many. And judging from history, the chances of such a path turning out well is essentially zero.
Yeah, we have plenty of examples of a vanguard party, you know, taking the reins of an unequal, unfair society, and in their attempt to revamp everything, they create far more misery than happiness.
So this is where naturalistic humanism offers an alternative, huh?
Yeah, absolutely, because the way we get there is as important as the destination itself, at least, if not more so. The journey there is kind of everything.
So,
we actually have a caller on the line, so let's try to get to that. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Who's calling and where are you calling from?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Who's calling?
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Ed. I'm calling from Jamaica, Queens. How you doing?
Hey, okay. Ed, you said?
Yeah, we've
had... Ed, yeah. We know you. We know you, Ed. Good to have you back.
How you doing?
All right.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is, do you believe that man is inherently good? And, you know, I've questioned that throughout my life, watching other human beings in my life do things that they do. And I'm still not sure, because if you're correct, if man is inherently good, and by providing, there's always got to be, I believe there's always room for self-motivation. But if man is inherently good, by facilitating the self-motivation, it'll manifest and it'll take place. But if man is not inherently good, then you know, the reward system that we have will be the only way it would work.
Yeah, Ed, you know, I thank you so much for saying this and putting it in the concise terms that you're putting it. Makes, you know, it makes it easy to talk about, and I appreciate that. What I want to say is, you know, it's not just that we're inherently good. It's that we're very contingent. If we don't get what we need, we can not meet our potential. But we have the potential for incredible social behaviors and caring, cooperative, wanting to contribute and participate behaviors. But that potential gets diminished if we don't get our development, if we're not developmentally supported.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I totally agree with that fact. But it's a toss-up for me. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
What you're thinking when you look at a baby? You know, sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, this is a good baby or a bad baby. It drives me nuts.
I don't think you can inherently tell an infant. I mean, you know, there's nature and there's nurture. You know, I mean,
exactly.
If an individual is presented with a good background and the resources and the nurturing that they need, that's one thing. But if an individual is it's a toss-up. Like I said, I've seen both sides. And one time I believed that it was one way. And as I get older and experience more, I find it difficult to believe that all human beings are that it's the rule of thumb that man is inherently evil. I think that there's hope. And that's
yeah,
that's good to hear. See, as you get older, you're getting a little more optimistic about people.
You're getting wiser, bro. Definitely. Ed, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. Call us again.
Thank you.
All right. And we have another caller. Go ahead, Elaine. Why don't you
sure.
Take that one?
Hi. This is WBAI, and you're on the air. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
Hello. Is that me?
Yep.
Yeah, that's you.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Ray. I'm calling from New York City.
Hi, Ray.
I believe we're all born with a blank slate. There's a song that says you have to be carefully taught.
That's a great song.
You know the song.
South Pacific, yeah.
there have been bellwether moments in my life and times. The first one, in chronological order, was Star Wars. I remember sitting in the movie, and when Darth Vader, the villain, who you knew were the villain, the audience stood up and cheered. It was chilling to me.
Ooh.
I remember a time before when you knew who the good guy was and you cheered for the good guy.
Yeah.
The second bellwether moment to me was when the program Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous came on. Prior to that show, many people did not know what wealthy people had, how they lived, and they were pretty content with having the basics of life. And shortly after the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous came a movie called Wall Street, where Gordon Gekko said, greed is good.
Yeah.
Right. And those things were broadcast to us. As I allude back to the first part, the audience cheered for Darth Vader.
What do you think that was about?
It was a bellwether moment. It was a changing of the times. I can't exactly put my finger on it, but I guess it's because he was such a powerful villain, people cheered for the power that he exuded.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah. In terms of drug addiction, I had a very wealthy friend whose parents were jet setters, and he wasn't happy. I knew he wasn't happy. He would lose himself in pills and booze. But I understood. His parents didn't give him much attention. Most of the time he spent was with the maids. They were like his second mother. There was Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Drugs.
Sure.
But there are reasons for that. Neglect, you're not getting enough attention. And the one most of all that really struck me, I don't know if you folks remember, was Christina Onassis.
Oh, yes.
Her father, I forget his first name, Mr. Onassis.
Aristotle Onassis.
While her mother was alive, he was philandering. He didn't pay much attention to her. And then her mother died in 1974. She was 24 years old. and her father didn't pay much attention to her. As a result, she couldn't quite make out who was on her side in society. She married a guy that was strictly out for her money. The poor girl, he divorced her within 3 years, got possession of the child, and then poor Christina Onassis, he died 14 years later at the age of 38, disillusioned and with a broken heart and alone.
Yeah.
Wow, Ray, I hadn't remembered her story. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't get what you need, it winds up showing up in life. I mean, look, Ray, there are exceptions. There are outliers who we keep getting pointed to as, oh, why don't you be like that person? He overcame or she overcame such adversity and succeeded beyond anyone's wildest dreams. Well, for every person like that, there are millions of people who are not like that. They're just normal people. And
that is true.
And what we do is we take these outliers and we kind of roll them out to torture regular people that are not outliers with those people and say, you know, you should be like that. And if not, it's all up to you because, look, they decided and they're doing well. You could do well, too.
You know what I found out in life from my experience? It's not what you know and how well you do it. Sometimes, well, most of the time, it's who you know. It's who you know.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, in the line of the elite and you travel in those circles, well, yeah, you know, you'll get a leg up, a hand up. But at sometimes you can work and work hard. That sometimes is a myth of the American dream.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's meritocracy that is, you know, that's not really the meritocratic system that it claims to be. But even if it were, the basic assumption that, you know, people, you know, if it are coerced to contribute, that they have that kind of pressure on them, there's something completely unhealthy about that. We need to take care of people first, and then they'll come through for us.
Well, you know, I don't think that's in the plan for the oligarchs.
I hear you, Ray.
Too true.
Anyway,
too true.
That's all
thank
I have
you.
To say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Call us again.
Thanks, Ray. That was really interesting.
Yeah. Now, I think we might have one more caller if they hung on all this time. This is WBAI. You're on the air. Hello? Hello? You got to turn your radio down. Okay. I hear the radio in the background, but I don't hear the caller. So, yeah. Caller's not making it, so we'll have to move. Yeah, hello.
There we go.
Hello.
Oh, okay, good. You're there. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, I did not know. I don't know why he called me. So, okay, my name is Gabriel. So I just have a very practical question. I need an email address. What email address I can write an email to you?
If you go to Naturalistic Support at the WBAI.org website, and you look for our program page, there is a email form there that you can send us an email.
There is an email address there.
Yeah, it's a form that gets that will get notified and we'll see
all
it.
Right. Okay, that's all. Thank you very much. Thank you,
Gabrielle. Thank you. And
I look forward to seeing what Gabrielle has to say to you, what she wants to write.
Yeah, me too. I'd like to see that. We had a couple good calls there, for sure.
Yes, and it bore out that point that you made, that it's not just the materialistic issues, it's the emotional support and attention, the nurturing that is needed as well.
Yeah, the Christina Onassis story is a great illustration of that, that, you know, you can get all the material needs met that you could imagine, but if you don't emotionally get what you need, there's going to be a hole in you.
Yeah, and I think of some of those people who get into the Ivy League colleges and they're sent there so that they'll meet the right people and they'll have all these connections that pave the way. and still turn out as monsters.
Yep, absolutely. We have another call on the line. Elaine, maybe you want to go for that.
Sure. Hi, this is WBAI, and you're on the air. Who's calling? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Elaine. This is Attila. I'm in Long Island. How are you?
Hi, Attila. Hi. Good to hear you.
Same here. I think people do have that inherent instinct, I guess, to be naturally kind and good-hearted. However, there must be consequences for actions, good actions and bad actions. Today, for example, I was driving by a local school here in Long Island in a no more than 20 miles per hour school zone driving, and a student go late for class, must have zipped by me going about 55, went through the stop sign, and happened to know the neighborhood, so I did follow him, and locally I found him, and I said, you know what just happened? He said, I'm late for class. And I said to him, I'm late for my life. Meaning, I could have been killed.
Yeah.
So, you could tell, though, that he was a good kid, maybe about 16, 17. And the point I'd like to make quickly, I know we're running out of time today, is there must be consequences, especially if we catch people when they're young and they learn about right from wrong.
But you did exactly what we call for. You didn't punish him. You reinforced the wisdom of why it makes sense to not speed like that.
And I reinforced it because I went to the school and saw the security guard, and I said, look, I don't like to bust chops, but someone could have been killed just now. There's lots of kids walking right in the middle of the street going to class. And I told them, I described the car with the plate.
Oh, dear.
And they said the principal's going to talk to them. So, yeah, there must be consequences.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how we react effectively to people that do break rules and do potentially harm others is a really big question. We did a couple of shows, if you might have caught them, on criminal justice and naturalistic humanism. And, it's not that we don't react, but we have to react in a way that is not pathological. You know, society's response to people who might do harm to others is to be so harmful ourselves that it, you know, there's very little distinction between the violence that one might do to another and the violence that our society is willing to do in an organized, you know, top-down way, which to me is it's not the right approach at all.
It's a difficult thing, and we need to apply what you both just said to the international arena. And I know I need not be specific, but we know what we all just witnessed on the news yesterday with the international arena. And
yes,
just
yes, exactly, with no consequences.
Just pathetic.
Yeah. And of course, the international arena is also one where our first response tends to be the Department of War, right? Our first response tends to be like, let's react with violence. And
exactly. Look how they renamed it, the Department of War. Right. I mean, that's crazy.
And violence is usually the last thing, you know. Violence is like throwing a match into, you know, a gasoline tank. You know, it's just the way, the opposite of what's needed. If we invested as much in a peaceful resolution of world problems as we do in violent ones, we'd have a very different outcome.
I love that. Yeah, absolutely.
Attila, thank you so much for your call. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you as well. I appreciate it.
All right.
You have a good week.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that's Attila is 100% right. We need effective responses to people that violate our society. And it's just not good enough to, to have this knee-jerk reaction. You know, we need to be effective. And What do you think, Elaine?
I think that Attila's initial reaction, talking to that kid, following him, confronting him, was the perfect response. Make that kid aware that he did something, that he was seen, that it was judged. But rather than have him punished, you know, his new license taken away from him, or something that would happen to make him pissed off with the world, I think what he did initially, speaking to him, was great. You know, if people do worse and they repeat offenders, you've got to take them out of where they can do harm.
Yeah, absolutely.
But first you try and nurture.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that even if he had not done the second step of going to the security guard, if he just spoke to him like he did, that might have been sufficient. For a lot of people, that would be sufficient that next time he would think twice.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we actually have to wrap it up. This went all too fast.
Oh, boy. Sorry about all the time that I was out of it here, but I was listening.
You're great as always. You've been listening to Naturalistic Support. I'm Arnel Doré.
And I'm Elaine Durbach.
Thanks to our talented engineer, Red Johnson, and to Hilla Weiss for her support. Tune in again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for another edition of our program. Archived editions of Naturalistic Support can be found on our website at wbai.org and at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Hi to my foster mom, Marilyn, and stay where you are, because coming right up is the Katie Halper Show. And remember, always try to be kind, because you never really know what someone else is going through.